We're going to take your phone calls in just a moment now with Graham Hancock right here on Coast to Coast AM. And that would include Fingerprints of the Gods and Supernatural. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. We've got Graham Hancock. We've got your phone calls as well. Do you think that this planet will be faced with another huge catastrophe?
Yeah, I think it's... I have to say that if you look at the broad span of history, the answer to that question has to be yes. We live in a difficult cosmic environment. The orbit of the Earth around the Sun is crossed again and again by huge asteroids, Earth-crossing asteroids called Apollo objects. Some of them 10 or 20 kilometers across. Actually, if you look at a diagram of this, it's truly scary because it seems like our little Earth is just winding its way through these massive objects that come flying at us from all directions. And sometimes we don't even notice a near miss until it's gone past. If you look at the whole issue of global warming now, that's not a new issue. Back 125,000 years ago, before the last ice age set in, we were in a period that geologists call the Eemian. There were astonishing climate fluctuations during the Eemian, much more severe than even we're experiencing now, although supposedly there was no industrial pollution at that time. You could have changes of temperature of global changes of temperature of as much as 10 degrees within a period of a decade taking place. And finally, that massive climate instability plunged the world back into the last ice age, which then lasted from 125,000 years ago, really down until 12 or 13,000 years ago when the last ice age finally came to an end. And during the ending of the last ice age, as ice sheets that were 2 miles thick on top of New York State, for example, melted down, and huge glacial lakes poured out their contents, scarring the landscape and adding 400 feet to sea level around the world. There were multiple catastrophes then. So if you go back even further to the time of the extinction of the dinosaurs, there's been periods of mass extinctions on our planet. So we have to say that it is a normal part of life on Earth from time to time to experience periodic, probably random cataclysms, which just are part of the deal on living on a planet in the universe, that there will be these disasters. And what life has to do is it has to bounce back. It has to be flexible. It has to cope. And the story on life on our planet over the last 4 billion years has been a story of unbelievable flexibility and resilience and the ability to not only survive a cataclysm, but to emerge from it renewed and refreshed and ready to develop in new and creative directions. So in short, the answer to your question is yes, of course, we will face another cataclysm. And the real test for us as human beings is how we deal with that and how we emerge from it. Do we become another extinct species like many others on this planet, or do we ride over the disaster into a new realm that lies beyond?
Okay, let's go to the calls now. San Francisco we go, west of the Rockies. Hello, Doug. You're up with us on Coast to Coast.
Hey, always great to talk with you, Mr. Norrie, and it's certainly an honor to talk to Mr. Hancock. He's had an enormous effect on my life in a most positive fashion, and I'd certainly like his opinion on a subject I'd love to relate to him.
All right, go ahead.
Thank you. I'd love to hear from you.
Oh, fantastic. I really want to thank you first for your Underworld. I mean, it really went on to expose megalithic architecture in the Japanese Okinawan Taiwanese island chain. Even today, the Korean and Japanese flotsam that's thrown off of their beaches from the public washes up on each other's shores. So your geological thesis of a united Korean and Japanese and Chinese peninsula during the last great epic of deep ice is, to me, unavoidable. I don't see how anyone can deny it. And the proto-Japanese Caucasoid Jomon people, who were the progenitors of the hairy Ainu in Hokkaido, is similar to the megalithic Mayan, who retreated from urban existence to subsistence economies later on, are possibly the people who created the sunken ruins that you mentioned. Even National Geographic Channel confirmed that they found carvings on those ruins. So anyone denying their validity just shocks me.
Yeah.
And certainly even Japanese cinema paid due homage to Daimajin, which was kind of like a pre-Japanese golem, if you will, which were megalithic sculptures of the Gikidojin, or gods of these people, who were the manifest wrath of gods, so to speak, who would walk whenever nature was threatened.
He's your research assistant here, Graham.
Yeah, this is fantastic. Fantastic call. I'm really, really, really pleased to hear it. Thank you for mentioning Underworld. After I'd finished Fingerprints of the Gods, my feeling was that I needed to take the inquiry to a new level, and it was clear that a global flood, which is what is documented at the end of the Ice Age, was part of the picture, and that's why in the mid-1990s I learned, and my wife Santa, who's a photographer, learned to scuba dive, took our lives in our hands, and went exploring for underwater ruins at depths down to about 125 feet all around the world. And indeed, a huge focus of our research was Japan, and we did hundreds of hours of diving in Japanese waters and found gigantic stone circles underwater, and of course thoroughly explored the mysterious complex at Yonaguni, the most southwestern of all the Japanese islands, and indeed went into Japanese mythology and the whole mystery of the Jomon. The fact is that there are megalithic ruins of unknown origin above water all over Japan, which most people haven't even heard of, and these ruins simply continue underwater. And when you do the geology, you find that vast areas of land were exposed before the end of the Ice Age that are now underwater. And I felt that it was necessary for me to take the inquiry to that next level. I only wish that marine archaeologists would also explore that instead of going diving always for shipwrecks, and that the funds of major marine institutions could be put a little bit into exploring the lands that were covered by rising sea levels at the end of the Ice Age. I think it would bring us a whole new perspective on human prehistory.
Absolutely. Off to Indiana we go now with Andrew, east of the Rockies. Good morning, Andrew.
Good morning.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to share a kind of a theory that I had about the whole Atlanteans thing when their islands went down.
Yeah.
We were talking about how they could have possibly gone to Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
And Linda was on last week talking about how, you know, the Mayans were really advanced and everything. And I thought maybe also quite a few of the people might have gone to Tikal, where the Mayans were located.
Tikal in Guatemala.
Yeah,
wonderful place. I've been there. I mean, Tikal is part of the overall Mayan culture, and I think we need to recognize, first of all, that the Mayans themselves are an extraordinarily ancient civilization, and secondly, that everything they built and created was built on top of an earlier layer of civilization and culture. The archaeologists know them as the Olmecs, which take us back into the mists of prehistory, and that certainly Mayan civilization and the Mayan sacred sites were a legacy of an even earlier culture, which in turn was a legacy of an even earlier culture before that, and that's what brings us back finally to the survivors of a lost civilization at the end of the Ice Age.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's all I really had.
All right.
Thank you for that point. Have you been to Tikal yourself, by the way?
Oh, he's already gone.
Oh, right.
Maybe he's on his way there.
Maybe so. Maybe so. It's a fantastic site. Absolutely amazing.
And we're not going to Santa Fe, Texas. Lynette on the wildcard line. Hi, Lynette.
Yes, hello. I'll make this really quick. Just a couple of quick points. You know, Edgar Cayce also prognosticated his reincarnation in 2012 in Nebraska.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I was wondering if anyone knows if there's been any surveys done with brain-injured patients. Sometimes people claim to be psychic after a traumatic head injury.
Mm-hmm.
And also, the alpha states that are achieved by the Buddhists, you know, as an example,
mm-hmm.
seem to scare governments like China. Do you think that's maybe because they're afraid of the power of collective consciousness? And I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Thank you. You've made an absolutely excellent point. Governments all around the world are deeply concerned by altered states of consciousness and absolutely want to stop us having those altered states of consciousness. And of course, visionary plants are not by any means the only way to get into altered states of consciousness, certain meditative techniques, such as those that have been explored and elaborated by the Buddhists, will also get us into the requisite altered state of consciousness. Even rhythmic music and certain forms of dance are capable of doing this. And wherever this happens, you find that governments want to stop it. They want to prevent it happening. And to me, this is one of the greatest conspiracies of the modern age, whether it's the Chinese government suppressing the altered state techniques of the Buddhists, or whether it's the American and British governments preventing adults from exploring their own consciousness with visionary plants. The common element is that the government wants to keep control. It actually wants to keep control of our consciousness. It may pretend to us that we are free to buy this or that. We can choose one or other commercial product, but really we're not free to explore our own consciousness. And there's a vast mind control game at work, which seeks to structure human thinking according to a very narrow pattern that serves the interest of what finally will turn out to be very small, powerful interest groups in our society.
All right, next up we go to Ohio. Mike, take it away. Hi, Michael.
Good evening, George and Graham.
Hi.
George, yeah. Have you ever seen John Carpenter's movie, They Live?
Yes.
Where the sunglasses let you see David Icke's reptilian people. Some suggest the sunglasses were a metaphor for the mushroom vision and therefore banned. And George, Graham is clearly Terrence McKenna's successor.
He sure Graham. Is.
Well, that's Graham. A tremendous compliment that you've just paid to me, because the late, great Terrence McKenna was one of the truly magnificent minds that has lived on this planet in recent times. A tremendous thinker, a man who was open to all kinds of possibilities that most of us are closed off to. And so I'd like to take this opportunity also to pay tribute to Terrence McKenna and to the wonderful, wonderful work that he did.
Okay, thanks, Mike. Next up, Ontario, Canada on the international line. Hello, Greg.
Good morning.
Yes, good morning to you.
My question goes back to your discussion on consciousness, and I was wondering if Mr. Hancock believes that consciousness is a phenomenon that is independent of matter, or if it's something that is tied up with the substance of our bodies.
Thank you for that question. I absolutely believe that consciousness is independent of matter. And I think that that one of the great mistakes of modern science is to believe that consciousness is generated by the brain. I think this is a mistake. I think that consciousness is mediated by the brain, much in the same way that a television signal is mediated by the television set to allow us to access it. The signal is there all the time, but we need a TV set to access it. I think that's what the brain is doing. And therefore, once you accept that consciousness is the essence and that the material form is simply a kind of suit or an avatar into which consciousness is situated, then you become open to the notion that consciousness must, of course, survive death. And you understand out-of-body experiences because consciousness is not dependent on the body. It is simply immersed in the body for a particular period of time. Consciousness, I believe, is eternal. I think it's one of the forces of the universe, like gravity, and it's been with us forever, and it's what the whole universe is about, actually.
Graham, what's your theory on how they moved those huge blocks of pyramid stone?
Well, we mustn't underestimate the abilities of ancient cultures who'd been working with stone for thousands of years to do things with stone that we can't do. But really, some of their feats go beyond the physical and require us to consider. And indeed, if you look into the ancient Egyptian myths, some kind of mind control, a science that harnessed the power of the human mind to move large objects independent of physical leverage. There are beams above the King's Chamber in the Great Pyramid, already 300 feet above the ground, which weigh 70 tons each and are made of solid granite. These things are vast. They're sort of room-sized beams. It absolutely beggars belief as to how they were got into place simply using humans pulling ropes. It just, you know, anybody who's actually seen those beams cannot believe that it was done simply by mechanical advantage, that they knew something that we didn't know. And there are myths that speak of the priests singing these huge blocks into place. And we have stories amongst the Tibetans of song, of sound, being used to lift blocks of stone. I think that there's a technology of consciousness that was used in the past to manipulate the physical world, which we've forgotten today.
Next up, we go to Colton, California. Hello, Joe. You're up with us on Coast to Coast.
Hey, Mr. Norton and Graham. How are you guys doing? All
good,
right?
Good to have you with us.
Fine, thank you.
And a real quick question. I just want to know exactly what is the Ark of the Covenant, really? I just want to know, like, what is its purpose? And like, I heard about it on Indiana Jones, and because you guys made a quick reference to it, but I just want to know, like, what kind of power it has, or what's the significance, or what exactly is the Ark?
Well, in the Bible, it is the it is the home of God on earth. It is the interface between the deity and human beings.
Yep.
It's why the first temple is built in Jerusalem. David is considered not pure enough to build it, but his son Solomon is, and he builds the temple, and it is built exclusively as an house of rest for the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord.
Wasn't it the depository of the Ten Commandments?
And the Bible tells us that it was the depository of the Ten Commandments, and yet when you look at the properties of these stones on which the Ten Commandments were supposedly inscribed by the finger of God, you find that a radiance emerges from them, that it burns the face of Moses, that it can cause blindness, that it contains a power that energizes the ark, almost like a power plant. It's a very, very, very strange. When you simply look at the ancient accounts and take them on their own terms, you find that you're dealing with something that has a spiritual function and also, weirdly, a technological function.
Didn't they say in the Bible that if you touched it the wrong way, you could get electrocuted or you could die?
Absolutely. There's the story of Uzzah, who is in the throng surrounding the ark as David is having it carried up. It's carried on special poles, which are wood covered in gold, which is a very strong insulating property, by a group of priests, the Levites, who are specially skilled in transporting the ark. It's always wrapped in hides, in animal skins, to prevent its radiance from damaging the crowd. And in this case, the ark is on the back of a cart, and it's seen to be toppling slightly, and this individual comes out of the crowd, Uzzah, and he reaches up his hand to steady it, and as he does so, a bolt of lightning comes out from the ark and strikes him dead. He's fried and killed instantly on the spot. And actually, there's many accounts in the Bible of the ark doing this. When the Philistines grab the ark and take it away from the Israelites for a while, after about 3 weeks, they give it back because it's caused amongst them a terrible outbreak of cancerous tumors. Well, what is that remind us of, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Fascinating, Graham. Fascinating work. Let's go to Caesar in San Francisco, California. Hi, Caesar.
Hello, gentlemen. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure thing.
Mr. Hancock,
yeah.
You may have single-handedly explained addiction on this planet. The suppression of expressing consciousness, I feel that the politics and religion of this world have made it possible for us not explore our consciousness, which is why people look to substance abuse and things like that to explore a different consciousness and a different way of thinking.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. And
sorry, I
hello?
Hello? I bumped him.
Well, just to pick up on that, on the point.
Hold it, Graham, until we come back, okay?
Okay.
We'll be back. We're going out into space tomorrow on our next Coast to Coast program with Robert Zimmerman, The Universe in a Mirror. When we come back, we'll take final phone calls with Graham Hancock on Coast to Coast AM. Nice job tonight, by the way, Graham. Very informative.
Thank you, George. Thank you. I'm really enjoying it.
The last caller before the break was talking about the higher states of consciousness.
Yes.
And, you know, the difference, I think, between getting into that with, as we've talked about, the altered states of drugs and
mm-hmm.
not.
Mm-hmm.
How can people at will do it without drugs?
Well, there are many techniques which have been developed by shamanistic cultures all over the world that allow us to enter altered states of consciousness without using drugs, very, very effectively. And these include rhythmic drumming, certain kinds of music, certain kinds of dance, I wouldn't rule out hypnosis as a technique for entering altered states of consciousness. Of course, we all enter an altered state of consciousness every night when we fall asleep. We should not ignore our dreams. In modern society, it's an insult to call somebody a dreamer because we so love the alert, problem-solving state of consciousness. But in ancient times, dreams were regarded as a valid way of knowing, and that it was recognized that valid and useful information came to us through dreams. But it's the case that the greater majority of shamanistic cultures around the world do use the visionary plants that have evolved alongside us as their allies in entering altered states of consciousness at will. And again, the puritanical streak in Western society tends to regard this as somehow wrong, although if we think it through and realize that brain chemistry is involved in every experience we have, I think we would discover that we're being illogical. Somehow it seems too easy, you know, to consume certain visionary plants, and it just seems we kind of feel from the puritanical background that Western cultures come from, we kind of feel that, you know, there should be agonizing work and pain in order to achieve these visionary states, and it seems somehow wrong that they can be achieved quickly using plants. But of course, the real important thing is what you do with the visionary state afterwards. I mean, my view is, you know, why walk 500 miles when you can take the train? The point is the destination that you get to and what you then do with the information that you get at that destination. And the process of integrating and acting upon visionary experiences, that's where the real hard work begins, where the individual is shown a different side of reality, perhaps is given information about himself or herself that is really important in adjusting their behavior. That's when the real work begins. It becomes with what we do with the visions. And therefore, I'm in favor of making it easier and more direct for people to attain the visionary state and providing a nurturing cultural background that will then allow us to integrate those visions and use them to improve our lives and indeed the quality of our society.
Okay, let's go to Florida. JJ, first time caller. Hi, JJ.
Yes, sir. How you guys doing tonight, man?
Okay, thanks.
Fine, thank you.
Just a couple questions for you here, Graham.
Yeah.
Now, I'm actually a big fan. I actually kind of started listening to your work, I want to say last year in 2008 is when I actually watched one of your things from George Norrie's show on
right.
YouTube. I'm not sure what the actual date was.
Right.
That's when I actually saw it at first, and I thought you were a very interesting guy. But and I don't want to offend you when I ask this next question because it's actually not meant to. It's just I don't know. But also, you know, I got your book, Supernatural. It's like a 600-page book, but, you know, it looks like it's going to be good. I'm definitely going to read that.
Right.
And I also got the 2012 movie you guys just did with Jim Mars and such. So
indeed.
Those should be good. But, you know, as far as I was just wondering, like, are you a scientist or are you like a lay person?
I'm a human being. I'm a journalist by training. My objective, my training has taught me to look into things, to investigate things, to dig up facts. The answer to your question is no, I'm not a scientist. I don't ever claim to be a scientist. And actually, I don't want to be a scientist. I think science, although it's done many wonderful good things, has also done terrible harm on our planet. And I think we need alternative points of view, which are nevertheless argued logically and based on real research. And that's where I've really tried to place myself, as providing an alternative point of view to science, but from a rigorous perspective.
Okay, so you're basically an investigator then. Okay, I see. That makes
I'm an investigative journalist. That's my background. That's all I am. I'm an investigative journalist with, I hope, an open mind.
Yeah, well, you got an open mind, man, no doubt about it. But I wanted to ask you a second quick question here, and I'll let you go real quick. I was just wondering, you know, generally speaking, like if you could talk about like some upcoming stuff that you'll be doing. I mean, you were talking about how you would like to get people more involved with going into these new states of consciousness and things like that. And I'm all for that. But you're saying that, like, the authorities are, like, stopping people from doing that. I mean, how are they doing that? And I would like to actually work to try and stop them. I mean,
well,
it's
done, of course, primarily through the war on drugs and the drug laws, which have handed over the keys to our consciousness to massive, publicly funded, armed state bureaucracies. And somehow the con trick is so cleverly done that most of us accept this without question. We demand our independence, we demand our freedom, our right as individuals, even our right to own guns, and yet we passively accept that our government, those men in suits, may control what we experience or do not experience with our own consciousness. I think this is a fundamental human rights issue. The right of the adult to explore his or her own consciousness in the privacy of their own home or in sacred settings without doing any harm to others. And I think that Americans and the Brits and all of the rest of the world need to wake up to this fundamental human right, which we are presently refusing illogically when we ourselves come from cultures that defend the freedom of the individual. There could be no more important freedom than the freedom of consciousness. And the whole history of human culture shows us that the exploration of consciousness through visionary plants is of great importance. This is one of the issues I go into in depth in Supernatural, and therefore we must resist this on human rights grounds, this passive acceptance of the government's right to hold the keys to our consciousness. As I always say, if I'm not sovereign over my own consciousness, then I'm not sovereign over anything. And let's not pretend that we live in free societies when our society will send us adults. I'm not talking about children. I do believe children's access to these substances should be controlled in the same way that we control children's access to alcohol. I'm talking about adults and adult responsibility, and it always stuns me that the Republican Party, which is so much in favor of the freedom of the individual adult and so much in favor of adult responsibility, nevertheless harshly advocates terrible penalties against people who use visionary plants to explore their own consciousness. This is a fundamentally philosophical, illogical position for the Republican Party to find itself in, and I think it needs to think about it again.
When you were doing all your research over all these years, Graham, was there an area that when you stumbled across it, you simply said, oh my God, I can't believe this?
Well, yes, very much so. And particularly for my research into Supernatural, for which reason I went down to the Amazon. I spent 5 weeks in the jungle, sitting down with Amazonian shamans and drinking the visionary brew called ayahuasca. It means the vine of the dead or the vine of souls. And it's used in the Amazon to access the spirit world and the teachings of the spirit world, and used particularly for healing because the Amazonian shamans believe that we can only properly heal ourselves if we understand the full context in which we're immersed. If we think that we're simply material beings and that there's nothing else to us but the matter of which our bodies are made, then we will never achieve a proper healing. We have to integrate the spiritual realm as well. And what ayahuasca, the vine of souls, allows us to do is to enter that realm and interact with the intelligent entities that live there. In the Amazon, they believe that a particular entity lies behind the ayahuasca vine. And this entity is envisaged sometimes in the form of a majestic human woman and sometimes in the form of a gigantic serpent, a boa constrictor, an anaconda type of serpent. And I, under the influence of ayahuasca, like many who drink ayahuasca, have met this being. And I met her at a time when I was very we always speak of her in the female form. And I realize for those who have not drunk ayahuasca how strange this may sound. But you do have a direct spiritual contact with a being who loves the earth and who loves human beings and who comes to us with a feeling of love. Her business is the planet, but she has time for the individual human. And I have encountered this being, and she wrapped herself around my body and rested that huge head on my shoulders and looked me in the eyes. I was feeling very low. I was feeling very negative about myself. And she said, you know, it's okay to love yourself. And she just beamed so much love and warmth into me over the 2 hours that this experience lasted, that it was utterly, utterly transformatory. And I could never emerge from that experience and believe that the world is as simple and as materialistic as our scientists insist. Yes, that was a transformatory experience for me.
Fred in Florida, east of the Rockies. Hi, Fred. How are you?
How are you?
Good.
On the consciousness plane, and you postulated that you could possibly meet aliens by changing your consciousness. when you have out-of-body experience, that's a change of consciousness. And I don't remember a lot of people saying that do have out-of-body experiences saying they meet aliens.
No, they meet spirits. They construe them as spirits in that sense. But many of the encounters have similar elements to that. An out-of-body experience is when your consciousness is released from the material envelope in which it is briefly contained while we live on this planet. And if that out-of-body experience also accompanies a near-death experience, if you're having that out-of-body experience because your physical body is actually dying or dead, then it plays an important transition role in moving you from one state to the next, so that you often get a complete life review. You get the chance to look at everything that you did with your life. You get the chance to learn the lessons that you were meant to learn while you were here. So sometimes out-of-body experiences are also near-death experiences. Then the patient is recovered and they have this memory and this realization that consciousness is separate from the body and that it goes on forever. So I think it's part of the overall phenomenon that I'm describing, but a very specific part of it.
Another thing I can't understand, and George, maybe you can help me on this, is people in the UFO community are not taken the thing, what Ed Grimsley is showing, which should answer a lot of questions with his night vision goggles. He's showing UFOs battling each other, moving around in different ways that are not satellites and all that. Nobody's really taking this serious. Why is this?
Well, I don't know the researcher whose work you refer to, but I can tell you why nobody takes any of this seriously, because there is a huge mind control operation in our society to stop us taking it seriously. Our society doesn't want us to know about these things. It wants to keep us narrowly programmed as consumers and producers of material goods, and it doesn't want us thinking about the wider extraordinary reality that surrounds us.
Indeed. Next up, let's go to Seattle, Washington. Hello, Brian. Thank you for holding.
Hey, Graham. Hey, George. How you doing?
Sure thing.
Graham, I just got back from actually a Peruvian Amazon drinking ayahuasca. And
oh, wonderful.
It was
wonderful.
Amazing. And I loved what you talked about in Supernatural with the therianthropic beings and,
yes,
and then topics and everything.
Yes.
I do visual art, and that's how I integrate these experiences back into my life. But I was just wondering, have you integrated your experiences with altered states into your life, and have these experiences opened up paths of studies beyond what you've written in Supernatural? Like, where is it going, and how have these altered states opened you up?
Absolutely. Thank you for that question. Ayahuasca has given a gift of art all over the planet. There is extraordinary visionary art being created by artists who've worked with ayahuasca, opening up whole new realms of artistic endeavor. Just amazing stuff. In my case, I'm not gifted with art. I can't draw to save my life. I can't paint. My hand and eye don't work that way. My gift appears to be with words. And the gift that ayahuasca has given to me is a novel. I've just finished writing a whole novel, which involves time travel and spirit worlds, and one character today and one character 24,000 years ago linked through the spirit world, fighting a battle of good against evil. And this novel has just been handed over to my publisher, and it's a gift to me from ayahuasca. The whole plot, the whole story was given to me in a vision. It won't be published for another year or so, and I'm not at liberty to talk about the title, but yes, I can say that I've had a huge creative impulse that has come from these experiences and has led me in the direction, for the first time in my life, to writing fiction rather than non-fiction.
Okay, good. Thanks, Brian. Next up, Los Angeles we go. Hi, Bob. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Graham Hancock, I met you, your wife, years ago when you were in Hollywood. I was unsuccessful in trying to get you connected with the Today Show.
Right.
But now I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
I was totally persuaded by the argument that the Sphinx's head is more recent than the body.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if the hole could date back to the age of Leo and therefore have originally been the head of a lion about 10,000 years ago.
Absolutely. In fact, I make that case in Fingerprints of the Gods and in The Message of the Sphinx. Thanks for mentioning this, because I mentioned John Anthony West and Robert Schock, but I forgot to mention Robert Bovall and his astonishing work on the Orion correlation and the correlation of the Sphinx with Leo.
He's good.
And Robert is a brilliant, brilliant guy, and his book, The Orion Mystery, is one of the great breakthrough works in this field. And in short, yes, that's what Robert is arguing, that the Sphinx is a marker for the age of Leo when the sun on the spring equinox rose against the background of the constellation of Leo, and therefore the Sphinx on the ground is the terrestrial counterpart of this celestial image, which is the sun in Leo, which, as a matter of fact, occurred around 10,500 BC, 12,500 years ago.
It is amazing work, Graham, isn't it? How many people like you are out there doing this?
Well, I think there's quite a lot of us. Some of us have been fortunate to be able to make it a full-time endeavor, but I highly value the work of individuals all over the world who write to me through my website and introduce new and extraordinary ideas, and I try to give them a forum on my website to publish their information. I think that everybody has something to bring to this mystery. There should be no specialists, no experts. We're all people with open minds who can bring new information to the inquiry.
I met you in Washington. Do you go to many conferences?
I've been cutting it back a bit while I've been writing my novel, but now that the novel is finished, I'm going to be going back to conferences again. I don't have anything immediately coming up, but I'm open for it.
You're in the United Kingdom right now, aren't you?
Yes, I'm in England, and it's coming up to 10 a.m. here.
My gosh, I just saw you a few days ago almost. You're all over the map.
Seems like yesterday.
Indeed, indeed. Give out your website one more time for
us,
Graham.
Yeah, it's www.grahamhancock.com, GRAHAMHANCOCK, and all the information is available there.
And the book is called Supernatural.
Supernatural.
Nice. All right.
Supernatural,
Graham.
Meetings with the Ancient Teachers of Mankind.
Right,
thank you so much, George.
Thank you for being on the program. Quite a guy. And that was kind of neat, because when I was in Washington, D.C. at the X conference, there he was tapping me on the back, and I turned around and went, "Hi," and he said, "It's me, Graham Hancock," and here he is on Coast to Coast AM. Don't forget, tomorrow program, Robert Zimmerman joins us as we talk about the universe in a mirror. It's about the Hubble Space Telescope. For Dan Galante, Jason King, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Ross Mitchell, George Knapp, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, we'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.